morning, witches. This is the Witch Daily Show with host Tanya Brown. We are coming to you from New Orleans, Louisiana, to offer you a bite-sized bit of magic. Our 20-minute-ish episodes are the perfect start to your day. So sit back, relax, and enjoy your pop of magic.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for listening to our new bonus segment, Witch Daily Show Mysteries. This was inspired by a few of our podcast listeners from our Facebook group and my new obsession with my mystery slash spoiler alert horror subscription box. I thought it would just be a extra fun thing. Like, who doesn't love true crime? And you know what? If you're not into it, don't worry. You can, like, totally skip it. It doesn't replace our normal episodes. It's just, like, a substitute teacher, right? A little extra fun for spooky season. And just a little something to focus on that is not the state of our world. So today, we are talking about the Somerton Man Mystery, a.k.a. the Tahom Shud case. On the morning of December 1st, 1948, the body of a man was discovered by Neil Bay and his friend on Somerton Beach in Adelaide, Australia. The man was about 40, 45 years old, dressed in a neatly pressed suit with clean, shiny shoes. He was laying on his back, legs crossed, arms resting on his belly, and his head resting against the sea wall. Neil and his friend told police that they thought he was sleeping because he was laying on his back looking up at the sky. Witnesses also came forward reporting to have seen the man the night before, but thought nothing of it, telling the police, quote, "We never took much notice because people used to sleep on the beach sometimes, especially if it was a warm night," unquote. The man had no ID, no wallet, and soon became the center of Australia's most prolific mystery. The police searched the man and discovered an assortment of items. On him, he had a second-class ticket for a train from Adelaide to Henley Beach, a bus ticket from the city, a U.S.-manufactured aluminum comb, half an empty pack of Juicy Fruit, and half a smoked cigarette on his right lapel, and an Army Club cigarette pack. He also had a quarter full box of matches. But what the man didn't have was what made police believe this was a unnatural death. His clothing had all the labels removed, and he had no identification. He had no wallet, for that matter. And this is a weird cultural thing, but he also didn't have a hat, which was, like, a really big deal. Apparently, they were so common for men to wear in 1948 that police were super suspicious that he didn't have one. Without an ID, the police used dental and fingerprints to identify him. You'll remember from one of our past episodes that it was thanks to a fingerprint record that Elizabeth Short was identified in 1947. Unfortunately, there were no records in the database matching the Somerton man. So he did have an autopsy, and here is what they identified. He was 5'11", with gray eyes and fair to ginger hair. He was in excellent shape, quote, top physical condition, unquote. The man had toes and calves consistent with those of a professional dancer. His last meal was a pasty, which according to historicuk.com, a typical pasty is simply a filling of choice sealed within a circle of pastry, with one edge crimped into a thick crust. The traditional recipe for a pasty is beef with potato, onion, and swede, which is then cooked together and sealed in the packet. His time of death was 2 a.m. on December 1st, 1948. There was a great deal of blood in his stomach and liver, and the spleen was 3 times the normal size, leading the pathologist to conclude that poison was the likely cause of death. Unfortunately, the poison was untraceable, so they could not confirm that this was definitely the cause of death. Pathologist Dr. Dwyer stated, quote, "I am quite convinced the death could not have been natural. The poison I suggested was a barbiturate or a soluble hypnotic." The pasty was not believed to be the source of the poison. Pathologist John Burton Clayland also examined the Somerton man. He agreed that the clues pointed to poison. In addition to the blood in the stomach and the liver, as well as the oversized spleen, he commented on the man's shoes. If he had been walking around town all day like they believed, his shoes would have been scuffy or dirty, but there would have been some sign. There would have been vomit or convulsions with poison as well. On January 14th, 1949, a suitcase was recovered by employees of the Adelaide Railroad Station. It turns out that the man took the train to Adelaide and checked his suitcase. The suitcase was brown and had no labels. So what was inside? Like, I'm sure everyone was dying to know. Inside of his suitcase was a red checked dressing gown, a pair of 7-size red felt slippers, 4 pairs of underpants, a pair of pajamas, shaving supplies, a pair of scissors with sharpened points, an electrician screwdriver, a pair of light brown trousers with sand in the cuffs, a table knife cut down into a short, sharp instrument, kind of like an old school shiv, a small square of zinc thought to be the protective sheath for the knife and scissors, a stenciling brush, one used by third officers on merchant ships, and finally, the last item in the case was something that caused a plethora of theories. A thread card of Barber brand orange waxed thread. This was dubbed a very unusual type, and it was not available in Australia. As with the man's clothing, like we said, all the labels had been removed. There were a few tags left on some items in the bag, such as a tie and a laundry bag, both with the label T. Keen, or Keen. Police believe that the labels were put there on purpose to lead them on a false trail, because there were no missing people by the name of T. Keen, or any variation of the spelling of Keen, in any English-speaking countries. After checking the train records, police believe that the Somerton man took the overnight train from either Melbourne, Sydney, or Port Australia. They speculated he showered and shaved at the city baths. There was no ticket on his person, so it was only a guess. He returned to the station and purchased the returning train ticket for the 10:50 a.m. train to Henley Beach. He obviously missed that train. While the suitcase revealed that the man might have arrived in Adelaide and how he got there, it didn't tell much more. Thanks to a little piece of paper, a secret pocket, and a book of poetry, this spark caught fire and has been burning ever since. All right, listeners, after this break, we are going to talk about this secret pocket and this little piece of paper. All right, witches. So I have some news. I have put in my 2 weeks' notice at my day job. A really wonderful witch friend once told me, never quit your day job. And I'm taking that advice seriously. I will be looking for something more fitting a little later. But for now, I really want to focus on my role in the magical community. While I am in this transitional time, I have opened up counseling, reading, and support services. And yeah, if you want to get a reading with me, if you need help wandering this crazy world called witchcraft, and you just need someone to hold the flashlight for you as you walk through this world, I want to be here for you. So if you have any interest, please head on over to witchdailyshow.com in our services tab, and you can find all that I am offering now. About 4 months into the investigation, a scrap of paper was discovered in a secret pocket sewn into the waistband of the Somerton man's trousers. The paper had "Tamam Shud" printed on it. This is Persian for "It is ended." After an appeal to the public, the book from which the paper came was turned over to the police. The book was found in a glove box of an unlocked car. The man who owned the car found the book and turned it over after reading about the search for the book in the newspaper. Now, when he found the book has been up for debate, as some sources say the book was found weeks before the Somerton man, which means the timeline the police put together was totally wrong. But other sources say it was found weeks after the man, which would mean the timeline was still plausible. The book in question was the Rubaiyat, a translation of a compilation of 12th century poetry by the poet Omar Khayyam. The scrap came from the last page of the book. After a closer look at the book, it turned out that there was a blank page just before the back cover that was torn out from the book. They noticed that there were imprints on the back cover, and they were able to recover what the man wrote. There were 5 lines of text that appeared to be an encrypted message and a phone number belonging to a Ms. Jessie Thompson. So, police called Ms. Thompson, and she claimed that her number was in the book because she gave it to a man she knew in the war, Alf Boxall, who was alive and well at the time. When they showed her a plaster cast of the Somerton man, she nearly fainted, but maintained she had never seen the man before. We'll come back to Miss Thompson in the theory section, as there are several having to do with her. So, what is the evidence that we have? And we'll actually get a special report from someone who does forensic pathology and get their opinion. So the evidence. We have the body itself, which was posed as a sleeping man, immaculately dressed, with freshly shined shoes and a shaved face. The autopsy report, revealing that the man's death was unknown for certain, but all signs point to poison. The man's belongings, i.e. the book with the cryptic message, and the suitcase with clues pointing to the man's and witness statements. What separates this from a ordinary John Doe case, and what makes it a prolific mystery, are 3 things: the book, the suitcase, and the mystery woman. The book is about living life to the fullest, and Somerton Man had a piece of the last page saying "it is ended" or "it is finished" in his pocket. Fitting for a suitcase, inside the book was the encrypted message and a phone number leading police to Jessie Thompson, a mystery woman who clearly knew him but refused to say so. The suitcase pointed to a man on vacation that was unceremoniously cut short, poking holes in the suicide theory. So, speaking of theories, what are the theories? The first theory is that he was a spy. The death coincided with two things: the start of the Cold War and the reorganization of the Australian Security Agency, which is like the Australian version of the CIA, apparently. He had the encrypted message in a book, and he was found smack dab in the middle of two places of keen interest to spies: the Radium Hill uranium mine and the Woomera test range. Plus, he had the unusual wax thread that some people paired with the idea of spy activities. Our second theory: murder. This is because the witnesses claim to have seen someone carry and place the Somerton man on the beach where he was found. Two, because his shoes were squeaky clean and he had been walking around town. And three, because he died of an untraceable poison, but there was no vomit or sign of convulsions. The only logical explanation for these things is that he died in one place, was then cleaned up, dressed, and placed on the beach. And the third theory is that he committed suicide. The police thought he tossed his wallet because he didn't want to be identified, and that he fixed himself up and, knowing his time was near, laid down on the beach to enjoy the feel of warm sand on his skin as he took his last breath. A poetic ending for someone who sewed a piece of paper containing the end of a poem into his pants. And then finally, there is a theory regarding his identity. The man married to Rachel Egan is a professor, Derek Abbott, who has been investigating the Somerton man since 2007. He believes that Jesse Thompson knew the man intimately, so well that he fathered her son Robin. Bearing a child out of wedlock was a huge no-no back then, so it was only natural she'd deny knowing him. It would have ruined her if she had admitted that she had a kid. But if we think a little bit more broadly and less gender shaming, if he was a spy, her admitting that she knew him and that her son was possibly fathered by him could put her and her son in danger. Abbott tried tracking down Robin Thompson, but he had already died. Abbott did find his daughter, Rachel, and the two fell in love and married almost immediately after meeting. He proposed 2 weeks after meeting her, and they're still married and have kids of their own. From Rachel, Dr. Abbott learned that Robin was a ballerina, and he thinks that this makes sense because the Somerton man had the build of a dancer. Being a dancer is a genetic trait, apparently, and the only way to be sure is to perform a DNA test, but the Australian courts haven't let him do this yet. So, listeners, after this break, we are going to go over the special report that we received from a forensic pathologist, and we'll go over some new evidence that may be coming out. Okay, I'm sure by now you're sick of hearing about my Hunt a Killer subscription box, but it is literally, I wish it was a job to get a box of evidence and to sit down and figure it out, because it is the most fun I've ever had. But what's really crazy is that, like, each box builds on the same case. So it's not like a case per month, but one case with more evidence. Working with your client, maybe she finds more things to send you and it builds on the mystery. But what's wild is you actually start to feel for these victims and suspects, and you kind of forget that it's just a game, because the box is set up in a way that it feels very real. You kind of forget other other people are working on the same investigation, are getting the same evidence. Like, my box last came with, like, an embroidered handkerchief, and it was just so pretty. I was like, oh my God, like, this feels real. It feels like real evidence from the story. And you kind of fall in love with the characters, the victims, the suspects, the people in the case. And my last box, each box has a goal, and the goal gets you, if you're right and you quote unquote email your client to let them know of your findings, and they tell you if you're right or not, in a storytelling way that lends to the storytelling. And the last box, they were just like, okay, so I need you to pick at least one person you think didn't do it. You know, we're starting to rule out suspects. And there's one character or one suspect that I just started to feel for. I was just like, this person just seems like a genuine person and a good person. And I think I would be heartbroken if they were the ones who did it. And so I sent the email to the client that I don't believe this person did it. And I was correct. And I was so pleased with myself. And then I felt some relief that the sweet, sweet person wasn't involved. So I don't know. I'm just obsessed with it. Obsessed with my Hunt a Killer box. If you want to check it out, this is not sponsored, but I do have my refer a friend link in the podcast description. It gives you a discount off of your box, and you get to just have some fun with it. I freaking love it, and it's the most fun I've had in a long time. All right, listeners, we are back. So I reached out to one of our other listeners who happens to be involved in forensic biology, and they gave their opinion. First of all, this is all quoted, quote, first of all, it's a shame that the suitcase and other belongings that were the Somerton man's were discarded, as there may be still some trace evidence that could have been analyzed. Even though the prospects for finding viable trace evidence would be slim at the time due to storage, and depending on how the items were stored, I believe it would still be valuable for fresh eyes to pore over what was there. I know that the quote torn from the book was later matched microscopically to the tear marks in the anonymous man's book, but document and paper analysis have come a long way since the 40s and 50s. And other evidence pertaining to the book itself could be discovered. Handwriting analysis between samples from persons of interest and the handwritten code on the back could also be conducted, although that may not be a possibility within the scope of this particular investigation. The most definite answers will be able to be gained through DNA analysis if the body of the Somerton man is exhumed. As it stands, the new Attorney General of South Australia has granted conditional approval of exhumation, the condition being that taxpayers don't pay for it. As such, Derek Abbott has agreed to pay for it, but it is unclear whether this will be through a donation from a benefactor or perhaps through crowdfunding. While formaldehyde use in the embalming process destroys DNA and tissues, DNA from teeth and bones remain more stable. If samples from these areas can be taken, a type of autosomal DNA profiling that looks at hundreds of thousands of different areas of the human genome can be conducted and compared to genealogy data from websites such as Ancestry. True crime fans know that is how they caught the Golden State Killer. If the Somerton man has distant relatives with genetic information on these databases, further investigation into the family trees could determine who he is and where he came from. Then, there's also the issue of whether Rachel Egan is actually his granddaughter, which can be easily determined. The simplest way would be using an STR profiling as mentioned previously. If Rachel and her mother gave a DNA sample, Rachel's father's DNA profile could be extrapolated from Rachel's sample, as half of your DNA is inherited from your mother and half from your father. there will be two DNA types present at each area tested. Comparing Rachel's profile with her mother's would enable analysts to eliminate the DNA types inherited from her mother, leaving DNA types inherited from her father, Robin. You could then compare Robin's DNA to that of the Somerton man. And if one DNA type from each location tested matches, it would confirm that the Somerton man was Robin's father and therefore Rachel's grandfather. If the DNA testing revealed that there is no familial connection to Rachel and her family, and if genealogical databases search come up with nothing, the only other analyst that I could think of that could provide clues as to the Somerton man's origins would be an isotope testing of his teeth. Isotopes are variants of particular elements on the periodic table. Isotopes of carbon and oxygen, in particular, are present in different quantities in different locations. So, she continued to say she wanted to add her own theory. She says, "I definitely think Robin was his son based on the anatomical evidence relating to the strange ear morphology and missing incisor teeth." So, when Robin, the baby that Miss Jessie Thompson had, they did examine the baby and found that they had similar ear morphology and the same missing teeth. So, yes, it's really, really interesting. And I've been following this case personally for a little while, so it's really fascinating. So, like we said before, there's no new evidence yet, but there will be. His exhumation of the body will take place this month, and it's scheduled to as well. In November of 2019, Dr. Abbott finally got approval to exhume the body of the Somerton man, and once exhumed, Abbott will take a sample of his DNA. So, first of all, it really is a shame that his belongings were discarded because, like we said, it takes away any opportunity for further analysis, but I know I myself am really hopeful that the exhumation of his body will provide more evidence, and maybe we can finally close a, 70, 80-year-old case of who is the Somerton man. I know my personal theory is that I do think he was a spy, and I do think he had an affair with Jessie Thompson. And I think it's as simple as that. I'm really curious to see what comes of it. And once we know, we will definitely do an update. Thank you so much for joining us for our bonus mystery of the podcast. A huge thank you to our Patreon listeners. And we will be discussing this case over on our Facebook subgroup, Witch Daily Show Mysteries, as well as voting for the next. This episode was written by Amanda Wilson, and all of our sources can be found in the podcast description. I also want to give a huge thank you for our anonymous forensic pathologist. Thank you so much. And until then, witches, stay bewitchingly vigilant and safe.